I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face. So my next interview is with Dr. Michael C. Klein. We talk about his new book, Dissident Doctor, My Life Catching Babies and Challenging the Medical Status Quo. What a pleasure it was to dive deep into this conversation with Michael about a whole lot of things. We talk about experience and about why he's been named a lifelong gadfly by others. We talk about how he spent most of his life rejecting the notion of a dispassionate doctor, and why that listening is the essence of family practice done well. It's fascinating, listening, and how important is that in pretty much every relationship that we step into, it seems to me, and how people's stories are a part of the diagnosis, and why family doctors need to be able to tolerate this thing called ambiguity. We talk about mentorship, we talk about his struggles with authorities, we talk about who his mentors were, but also how important it is to him to mentor others as well, and how you need to pattern yourself after somebody that you admire. By the way, you're going to love the book, Dissident Doctor. It's on the shelves now. You're going to want to get it. This is a story, and many stories wrapped within a story, it seems to me. They're funny, they're interesting, they go deep, they're full of insight. So pick up the book. Hope you're going to enjoy the interview. In fact, I know you're going to enjoy the interview. Stay tuned. Don't forget davidpecklive.com for more information about my speaking and my writing, and also facetofacelive.ca for a whole slew of interviews with some pretty fascinating people doing some pretty remarkable things. Stay tuned for Dr. Michael Klein coming right up. Oh, and please, if you don't mind, take a few moments to, if you're enjoying what you're hearing, please leave a review on iTunes. I know it would mean a great deal to me personally, but it means a whole lot to the digital world as well. Coming right up, Michael Klein, Dissident Doctor, don't touch that dial.
Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by a very special guest here with us today, Dr. Michael Klein, here today to talk about, well, a whole lot of things, I think, but most importantly, to talk about his new book, Dissident Doctor, My Life Catching Babies and Challenging the Medical Status Quo. Thanks for joining us today, Dr. Klein.
You're most welcome.
So I'm going to just, I hope you don't mind, but can I call you Michael? Is that all right?
Sure.
Excellent. So we're on a first name basis. This is fantastic. It's just a good way to start a conversation. So first of all, congratulations on the book. Tell me a little bit about the launch coming up, and then we'll just dive right in. But I think on September the 6th, Sunshine Coast, there's something going on.
There's the first launch of the book is on the Sunshine Coast, which is where the publisher resides as well. And it's at the Art Center in Seashelt at 7 o'clock. And I'm looking forward to that. Then there are a series of other launches across the country, including at the Toronto Public Library the day after Thanksgiving, where I'm actually going to be interviewed by André Picard. And then there's going to be one in Montreal, where I've spent almost 25 years. So.
So again, congratulations. And in a way, having read the book, and thank you for an engaging, so narrative driven, so many stories, fascinating life that you've lived. So thanks for the story and the insights and the questions you raised too. But you've been called probably my favorite, a lifelong gadfly, a radical physician and a citizen. Can you kind of provide for our listeners on Face to Face a little bit of context for your diary that you're now releasing to the world, essentially, Dissident Doctor?
Well, frankly, this book was something I was writing for the kids, and it got out of hand. I'm a well-established researcher, and I've written almost 200 scientific articles, but this is my first book. And of course, you can appreciate that it's a very different experience to write a book that is meant to be accessible to both professionals and the public in general. And I wrote it with that in mind. And it was a bit of a challenge, but I avoid jargon, and I hope I've been successful at doing that. But I describe what I hope is a through line that links my early growing up to how I decide to be a physician and ultimately what kind of a physician, and tie that into some issues that I'm very passionate about. And yeah, I was very much influenced in my development as a physician by experiences that I had as a medical student that are rather unusual, that I think shaped me in many ways, including experiences in Mexico, near Guatemala, working in an anthropological project, and then spending a year and a half in Ethiopia, working in a children's hospital, and being exposed to midwives. And all of those early experiences shaped the kind of physician I would become and the kinds of values that I think are important.
You've got a great photo in the book where you're wearing a shirt that says real men love midwives, and you've for a scientist who's written 200 scholarly pieces, for an academic, you've got a great sense of humor as well. It seems to me, based on what I've read and how colored and eclectic and vast your experience is, I mean, I guess there's a question here, but there's also some admiration. How did you maintain such a sense of humor? And was it something that you actually had to lean on from time to time to see you through some of these pretty crazy situations, ER-like situations?
Are you talking about the politics of the practice?
Yeah, fair question.
What I learned in both the research that I've done and in my administrative responsibilities is that you really mustn't take criticism personally, because if you're doing anything worthwhile, you're going to get a lot of criticism. The midwifery criticism occasionally came even from my own colleagues in family practice. I mean, there was a small group of people in the department that I headed in Vancouver at BC Children's and Women's Hospitals, where I was head of family practice for more than 10 years, who just could not fathom the idea that a head of family practice could be a supporter of midwifery. And there was, in fact, a proposal made to have me impeached for that. And of course, it never went anywhere, but still, you know, you have to maintain your sense of humor. And there are many times when trying to run a large department with many different actors, it was essential to maintain that sense of humor. Otherwise, life became pretty grim, and I never took it that seriously at one level, but at another level, I was deadly serious.
Well, it seems to me that there's an insight there, and I think this is for sure a common thread throughout your book. You know, you're bringing you know, you brought family medicine together with maternity care. And I love how you reference Thomas Kuhn and the structure of scientific revolutions. And you talk about this paradigm shift and how, you know, we're so rooted in our context and our framework and so on. And yet you push back, you know, you raged against the machine, I guess you will. And you were able to take the conversation, not only the conversation, but our action to the next level. And it seems to me that, you know, alongside of that, a lot of doctors I've met over the years kind of lack a good sense of humor. And I wonder if there's this, you know, you talk a great deal about being able to have conversations and about good family care and about being, you know, really self-aware, it seems to me, as a medical practitioner. And I sometimes wonder if, is that something that's kind of missing from not just our system, but healthcare in general, this holistic relational approach?
Well, I think that's exactly right. I think that, you know, one of the quotes that I use at the very beginning of the book is from Sir William Osler, who says, if I'm paraphrasing now, but I may have it just about correctly, he says that it is more important to know what kind of patient has the disease than what disease the patient has. And so that was written in the late 1800s. So these ideas are not new, but it's essential that even somebody as formative to what we now consider to be modern medicine, you know, had that idea even back then. So it's not a new idea from me at all. Another way that I think about it, and I think I know what you're talking about, is that at some level we may have been taught, and maybe it's still taught, that the doctor should be the dispassionate physician scientist.
Right, right, disconnected.
Disconnected, and I reject that. I think that not only that, but you should not, in a sense, use your own personal experience and life trajectory within the therapeutic relationship that you have with your patients. I think that's quite wrong. That in fact, you must use your own experience, and it's perfectly legitimate to share some of your own personal experiences. And sometimes it's impossible not to. So, for example, in my life, almost 20 years as head of family practice in Montreal at the Jewish General Hospital and the Herzl Family Practice Center, I mean, all my patients knew about my wife's illness as a small community. And at many levels, they were more worried about me than I should have been worried about them. Of course, I was worried about them, but sometimes they wouldn't even allow me to look after their needs because they were so concerned about what was happening in my own life. And so those experiences were integrated into my own practice, and the alternative therapies that we used to help my wife get through her experience. You know, Bonnie would have had many problems that she didn't have if she hadn't been able to be exposed to those less conventional therapies. So I was open to all of that, and so it helped a lot. It also helped in my own occasional illnesses to be able to go outside the Western medical box.
You talk about early on in the book, you talk about how you integrated soft methods into your practice. Is that kind of what you mean? Is that synonymous with sort of non-conventional approaches?
That's right. So I was one of the first doctors in Montreal to begin working with acupuncturists and with massage therapists and with a variety of other so-called alternative therapies. And I even exposed my residents to it because I was running a teaching center, and I used to send my residents off to spend time with acupuncturists and other people, and so that they could deal with their own inherent prejudices, which we all acquired when we were in medical school.
You talk about at one point, and I'm going to see if I can pull up a quote here, but you say something, and it's related to, you know, some of the groundbreaking work that you've done on episiotomy and so on, but you say, my crime, question mark, I was delivering babies without episiotomy. You're talking about some time you spent at, I believe, at Stanford, and one of your, I don't know, superiors, I guess, calls you into their office and you say, you know, red-faced, and I think a little bit of your sense of humor is coming out here for sure, but basically your crime was for pushing back against the status quo, for not being conventional. You've taken a certain amount of heat over that throughout your career.
That's right. I mean, you know, when I was exposed to midwifery in Ethiopia, I was learning from midwives in Ethiopia before I actually had my conventional obstetrical clerkship at Stanford Medical School.
It's amazing.
So what they taught me, I thought was normal. And so when I got back to medical school after taking a year and a half off, I had very little left to graduate, but one of them was obstetrics and gynecology that I had to take. So on my first day of my rotation, I was delivering babies under supervision without episiotomy. And the professor and chair of obstetrics and gynecology at Stanford University Hospital tapped me on the shoulder and said, come into my office. And he basically said, if you want to practice primitive medicine, you're going to have to go to the county hospital. And he actually exiled me to the county hospital. Wow. Where I had a perfectly wonderful experience. I won't go through the details.
Well, I was just going to say, maybe the best place for you to be.
Well, it was perfect. And of course, this was in the 60s, and the academic discipline of family practice hadn't yet been articulated yet in either the United States or Canada, so that, you know, I didn't have a label for what it was that I was doing.
Right.
I was actually, in retrospect, practicing family medicine, but it was a wonderful experience, and I was able to actually deliver babies and then look after them, and that was not part of normal medical education, because everything was siloed, right? The pediatricians did this, the obstetricians did that, and
right.
So on.
Well, and you make it very clear in the book too that you specifically stepped outside of that kind of vertical or that track of specializing. You actually went from specializing to general practice, and you think there's actually there's a disconnect there for our sort of specialists, if you will.
These days, it's very hard to go from special to general. It goes the other way around. You start off as a general practitioner or a family physician, and you stay there. In the old days, a lot of general practitioners went on to specialize, and they made some of the very best consultants. And but I haven't stopped being a pediatrician or a newborn intensive care specialist. I just added family practice, and I discovered that I was really meant to be in family practice, but I never saw a family doctor all the time I was in medical school at Stanford, so I could hardly become one. I'm sure it's hard to find one even now.
You know, there's so many things I want to ask you about there, and I really do want to talk about mentorship. You talk a great deal, very affectionately, about a man who was a significant impact, had a significant impact in your life, in Dr. Waldies, Ezret Waldies, and from Ethiopia. I'd love to hear more about that, but clearly you're a compassionate listener, and you talk about that in one of the late chapters in the book. You talk about standing in other people's shoes. You talk about self-advocacy and how to be a pain in the ass, actually, I think is how you end the chapter. Is that what doctors are kind of missing today, or a lot of doctors, is this idea of actually being able to listen well?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I mean, I think that listening is the essence of family practice done well. And the idea that people's stories are essential to making a correct diagnosis is something that we do teach. And listening, you know, is very much a part of that. I mean, family doctors often begin to hear patients' stories that are really not about diseases, but are about feelings and about symptoms. And symptoms later turn out to be diseases, but the diseases may not be the same diseases that are traditionally labeled in conventional specialist practice. They may have the same labels, but the diseases are different, and they often present themselves much, much earlier. And family doctors need to be able to tolerate ambiguity, need to be able to use time as a diagnostic tool. And the way you use time as a diagnostic tool is to listen to people's stories and listen longitudinally. You know, it's you don't solve all the problems in the first visit unless you're dealing with trauma, you know, physical trauma or something like that.
So listening longitudinally is looking back, is making connections, is sort of taking a more holistic approach, in a sense.
That's right. But the longitudinality is what's important. So you hear symptoms, and then symptoms evolve, and then they become clarified with the passage of time. And you have to be able to tolerate that. If you're a family physician who needs to have everything nicely tidied up and packaged in a 10-minute visit, you're going to be unhappy, and so will your patients be unhappy.
So it sounds like you've been a mentor to many. You've talked about, you know, learning from midwives in Ethiopia before you had even really, you know, gone through the academic training. I think there's a marvelous lesson there about I'm an electrician by trade, actually, and I don't work on the tools anymore, but I spent 8,500 hours of my early career as an electrician learning from others, you know, side by side, this kind of elbow knowledge, and it seems to me that, you know, that's clearly been a thread for you. Can you talk a bit more about that? I mean, is that a practice that's being used today? Does that come out more when we're talking about specialists? Is this idea kind of of an apprenticeship, I guess, if you will, or an apprenticeship where it's a two-way street, I suppose, is maybe what I'm kind of talking about.
Well, I think that both generalists and specialists today in medicine are an apprenticeship model, and I think the patterning of yourself after somebody that you admire is critically important. If the person that you're learning from is a humanist, you're likely to become a humanist. If the person that you're learning from is not, then you're likely to pattern yourself after that person as well. So, you know, choosing the right kind of teachers and having the right kind of faculty is critically important. And in the book, I tell the story of my father's care in a major teaching hospital. And one of the extraordinary things that I noticed was that he was cared for in a coronary intensive care unit, which changed specialists every Friday. And if the specialist on duty was a humanist, the residents were humanists. If the specialist was not, the residents were not, but they were the same residents. The residents were constant, the specialist changed, and the residents were like chameleons. And they just adopted the approach and values of whoever was the attending for that week. And, we have a joke in family practice. There are three principles of family practice education. The first is role models. The second is role models. And the third is role. There are no other principles. So you've got to choose your faculty well and make sure that you're teaching the right messages, and you're teaching a kind of humanistic professionalism as opposed to a dry, clinically dry clinical discipline without any humanism.
Well, it sounds like it's got to be deeply relational, and there, There has to be a face-to-face component. There's an elbow-to-elbow component. Yes, it's about mathematics. You talk about mathematics. I love the fact that, by the way, there's so many things to talk about, but I love the fact that you say, admit, basically, that if you tried to get into medical school today, you might not get in.
I'm sure you wouldn't. I'm probably challenged.
I think it's wonderful to be able to look back at your career with those type of mathematical challenges. What was it, Einstein? Didn't Einstein say something that the statements of mathematics are certain only when they make no contact with reality? I think was something he said, and I think you've proven maybe that's true. What about your mentors? What about your role models? So you're a conscientious objector in 1967, I believe. It kind of drives you north. You come into Canada, and you know you sort of never look back in a sense. Can you talk about how you got there? I mean, that's a pretty significant step to take as a young man. Clearly, a very principled at the time, but love to hear a bit more about that.
Well, in the last part of my the book, in fact, it's the last page. I have a page dedicated entirely to mentors, and I have a whole series of mentors, and I can name them all, and I know what they all have in common, and that is they all had their own struggles with authority, and they all were expressing ideas that were not popular or not conventional, and yet they were dissident themselves. And I came to that realization toward the end of writing this book as to, you know, who were all these mentors? There are about 10 of them. And I know all of them. My first mentor was a pediatrician at Stanford named Robert Greenberg, who was a pediatric endocrinologist. But he was... I loved the way he talked to patients, and I loved his politics. And he and I marched together against the Vietnam War in San Francisco. I wanted to be just like him, which is probably why I became a pediatrician. Family practice wasn't available to me at the time, so he was my first mentor. But then I had a whole series of other mentors in each case. They were individuals who contested the current status quo, as the subtitle of this book suggests. But at the same time, they were skilled communicators and were skilled teachers and had values that I admire. So in each case, that was what made a mentor for me, was somebody who I admired as a person.
When you talk about the brotherhood of man as being one of the things that you applied to your pushback against the U.S. government, you'd tried to use sort of religious language to say, I'm not going to go to Vietnam. I'm not the right guy for this role. But you ended up sort of taking this brotherhood of men. Is that sort of what you talked about earlier, this human, more of a humanist kind of an approach? Is that what you mean by that? Because clearly, as I said, you know, you talk about compassionate listening and self-advocate and those kinds of things that we've talked about before. Seems to, again, be a real consistent thread for you.
Well, let me just deal with the Army briefly.
Yeah. isn't that how they should be dealt with, briefly?
Yeah, right. Well, I had many reasons for not wanting to be part of the Vietnam War effort. But in those days, every doctor was drafted without exception. And I also was drafted. And the whole story of that is a major chapter in the book. I won't dwell on it too long. But critically important is the following. There is a document called the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which is the document of the U.S. Army that outlines the roles and responsibilities of everybody in the Army, from the private to the general. And there is a section on the medical officer. So every medical doctor in the Army is an officer. And that the job of that doctor, as specified in the Uniform Code of Military Justice, is to support the mission and to return the soldier to combat. And returning the soldier to combat, whether they're really ready to go back or not, because that's the Army wants that soldier carrying a gun and on the line killing people. And so for me, being a military doctor was really no different than carrying the gun myself. Mm. And that's why I could not participate in the war. That was an idea that could not even be fathomed by my draft board, who, you know, I had a 7-minute hearing. So, but that was critical for me. And eventually, I was brought in as an officer. It was either that or being a foot soldier. They told me very clearly, if you don't accept your commission as an officer, we will draft you as a foot soldier. So I played that game with them, but I also told them very specifically what orders I would and wouldn't follow. And I, you know, made very clear what my values were and how incompatible they were with the Army's values. And my hope was that they would basically give up on me and decide I was more trouble than I was worth. And it took them a few years to figure that out, but they did do that. And so in those days, there was an amnesty under President Carter. I didn't get that amnesty because I'd created my own kind of amnesty when the Army decided that I was indeed more trouble than I was worth.
And so you headed north. I'd like to hear too a little bit about the context of the time that you were in. You talk about Pete Seeger and the McCarthy era, and you get into a little bit of that political side of things during the. How much influence did that have, would you say, on you as well? You know, you marched with this other. You know, you talked earlier about marching and conscientious objector, dissident doctor. I mean, you know, pushing back has been a part of who you are, it seems, and yet pushing back for the right reasons. I'm just kind of wondering about, you know, your friends at the time, what you were reading, what you were listening to, and so on. How influential was that?
Well, a lot of this came from my own family and growing up. Now, my father was an animator at Walt Disney, you know, Bambi, Pinocchio, Fantasia.
Right.
And he was also an organizer, one of the organizers of the Screen Cartoonists Guild. And, you know, during the McCarthy period, his early union activities and left-wing activities came back, and my mother as well, came back to haunt them. And, you know, we were always expecting a knock on the door.
Right.
And sometimes it happened. And so that whole era was a very hard one for the whole family. And as well, there was the distinct feeling from even before high school that we were other. We were not like other kids, and you didn't share that with, in the 50s, you didn't share that with your schoolmates. So I lived a kind of dual life. I knew children who were coming from families like mine. They're known as red diaper babies.
Right. That was one of my questions to you. I actually thought about starting the interview by saying, so Michael, what exactly is a red diaper baby anyway?
Yeah, that's what it's called. And so I was exposed to people with those values, but I also went to a high school, the same high school that Philip Roth and Jerry Lewis went to. It's called Wequahic High School in Newark, New Jersey, where values were quite different and where I wouldn't share my family values with my classmates. And so that was difficult. Mm-hmm. Because I was living this schizoid existence, which I think also in many respects led to becoming a doctor in a way. This may be retrospective thinking, but when I was looking for, you know, who I would become, I wanted independence. I didn't want to be, I didn't want to suffer the kind of dependence that my dad had suffered when he was eventually blacklisted and not able to work during the McCarthy period. And I remember those days vividly. I remember my dad working at home on a draftsman's table, which I still have, the one that he built, that he used his, for his cartooning. But in this case, he was working in the middle of the living room under a pseudonym, you know, making terrible cartoons under somebody else's name. And I remember all of that. And I didn't want to be in a position to be dependent on anybody else. And I had this notion, perhaps a false notion, that being a doctor would allow me to have the independence that that I wouldn't be exposed to that.
Well, in one sense, it seems to me it prepared you well for the system, but it also prepared you well to push back against it. And it seems to have worked out pretty well for you.
Well, and there's also another kind of paradox, and that is that wherever I have been, whether as a resident, I was always chief resident, and I've always been head of a department. Head of a department continuously from 1970. And to be honest with myself, I don't like administration very much. And so what the hell was I doing with all this administration?
Right.
And the answer must be I'd rather work for myself than for somebody else,
right.
even if. But at the same time, being in those positions allowed me to do things that I might not have been able to do.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Both organizationally, politically, in research terms.
I sadly, we're going to have to wrap up our conversation here shortly. I feel like we barely scratched the surface. I wondered if you could, just before we wrap up, I did have one final question. You call your story a love story, and I wanted to ask you about that. But I also wanted to see, could you talk about, near the end of the book, you do talk about private healthcare. And it is a bit of a warning, I think, you know, for Canadians, for globally. Can you just unpack that a wee bit?
Absolutely. So I'm in a unique perspective here. I practiced in Canada before Medicare. I practiced in the United States. I ran a neighborhood health center network in the United States for 5 years, of course, without universal health care.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came back to Canada in 1975 when where Medicare had been in existence for 5 years. And I knew very well from practicing in the United States what I didn't want to practice. And the decision to come back to the United from the United States to Canada was to never experience that kind of healthcare again.
Mm.
I'm on the board of Canadian Doctors for Medicare, and our objective is to preserve our healthcare system from encroachments from the American multinationals that are salivating at the Canadian market, and they would just love to get a piece of it. And they're, of course, they already have a piece of it, and we are at risk of turning into the United States. Now, having practiced in the United States, clearly, my wife Bonnie and I, of all people, don't want to see our Canadian healthcare system turn into United States. So I put a lot of energy into addressing the issue of avoiding privatization. That doesn't mean accepting the Canadian healthcare system as it is. There are lots of problems with waiting lists, and lots of ways of correcting those problems. But to do so, Canadians have to really recognize what it is that they have, and almost all Canadians do, and make sure that the system is well enough funded and organized, so the temptation to develop a hybrid system that allows for more well-to-do people to get to the head of the line be what we have in Canada. The essential principle of the Canadian healthcare system is equity. And if we lose equity, we really lose the essential characteristic of the Canadian healthcare system. And that's what's at risk here. So I do write about that in the book, and I feel passionate about protecting it, protecting our healthcare system, but improving the healthcare system within a universal system. And that includes also thinking very seriously now about universal pharmacare and dental care and a lot of other features of our healthcare system that have yet to be developed and are very much needed.
It's a great, to me, it's a great metaphor, really, for what you've lived, the life that you have lived, the approach, the universal approach that you've taken, and frankly, if I can say it, the love of the other or the love for the other, in you know, back to Mexico, back to Ethiopia, and so on, and just the communities that you worked within. You call it a love story, Dissident Doctor, in the beginning, in the intro, I think even. We're all a part of a love story of one kind or another, it seems to me, for good or for ill. Is that a principle? Is that a place we can start? Is that too idealistic, Michael? Is that ridiculous of a statement? You know, I mean, it seemed to work for you, so I'm just wondering.
I think it's a great metaphor.
Start with love. Is that the way forward?
Yeah, I think that's a great metaphor and a good way to start.
Thanks so much for your time today. We've been talking with Dr. Michael Klein about his new book coming out very soon. In fact, available now, Dissident Doctor, My Life, Catching Babies and Challenging the Medical Status Quo. I really, really appreciate your time today. We barely scratched the surface. I mean, we're going to have to do a part two, it seems to me.
Well, I'm ready.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.